Good afternoon, everyone. It's Tuesday, March 4th, and we are now in session at approximately 1:37 p.m., bringing this meeting to order. With us today, Senator Olson, Senator Michicki, and myself, Senator Dunleavy. We do have a quorum. Once again, a reminder, please turn off your phones or other noise-making devices. The plan today is to hold the first meeting on several bills and hold them over for a future meeting. So the bills today that we're going to be going over, SB 166, Board of Nursing, Nurses, SB 167, Multiple Vehicle Insurance Policies, SB 189, Exemption, Licensing of Contractors, SB 193, Contractors, Bonds, Licensing. First bill we're going to turn to today is SB 166. It is sponsored by Senator Giesel. This is the first hearing on the bill. We have a draft CS before the committee, which incorporates changes requested by the sponsor. So we would ask that Senator Giesel and staff come up. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for hearing this bill. For the record, I am Senator Kathy Giesel. I represent Senate District N, November. That's the Anchorage Hillside, the communities of Turnagain Arm, Eastern Kenai Peninsula, and northern half of the Kenai Peninsula. Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 166 is a simple bill. It's actually analogous to a reviser's bill in that it is eliminating obsolete statutes from the Board of Nursing and updating obsolete statutes. The reason this has not come before the legislature as a reviser's bill is that the revisers don't dig into really technical professional bills. So the boards themselves have to make those changes. These changes have been on the docket for the Board of Nursing for at least 10 years. During the 7 years that I served on the board, we actually developed this list, and we're finally bringing them forward. The board has asked that these be brought forward for correction. So we have a sponsor substitute, which I will have my very capable staff, Jane Conway, talk you through.
Okay, 1 minute before we do that, is there a motion to adopt the CS as our working document?
There is, Mr. Chair. I move that committee adopt CS for Senate Bill 166, version Y, as the working document.
Thank you. And I object for purposes of discussion. Let's continue with the testimony. Thank you.
For the record, my name is Jane Conway, staff to Senator Giesel. Two small changes from the version O to version Y. Version Y rewrites the whistleblower protection section to include both the nurse that delegates a task to another not educated to perform the task and the nurse asked to perform a task that they are not educated to perform. So that is the first change on version Y.
Excuse me? And that is on page where?
Page 7, beginning on line 28.
Page 7, line 28, whistleblower protection. Thank you.
And then at the very end of the bill, there was another change that was needed because in the original draft, legal did not write out the name of the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. And so that was fixed at the very last section of the bill, page 8, line 19.
Department of Labor and Workforce. Thank you.
They originally had Department of Labor.
Thank you.
So, Chairman, that are the only changes from version O to Y.
Thank you. questions at this point from members of the committee. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Giesel, what were some of the obsolete, give me an example of some of the obsolete statutes that were on the books and were rewritten?
There is a reference in here to vocational nurse. Vocational practical nurse, those no longer exist.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator.
I'm assuming that's a three-year program you're talking about that used to be there?
Actually, practical nurses are typically 2 years, two-year programs.
Okay. So a person that has a two-year RN degree is?
That's an RN degree. There's also a practical nurse degree.
Sure.
Okay. And they were in the past called vocational nurses. That term is obsolete. They're now called licensed practical nurses. There's also a a statute that requires the Board of Nursing to give a written exam. The exam is no longer written. It's a computer-based exam. Let's see. There's also some in here, some recognition of the Canadian licensing exam. We don't accept that exam anymore, only the National Council's exam. Really, all of this is pretty much update other than the whistleblower and the qualifications for board membership, which is in Section 5. This is updated, first of all, to add the practical nurse identification, but also to identify length of practice to serve on the board. In other words, they have to have practiced for several years before they would be able to sit on the Board of Nursing. And it also creates a designated seat for the advanced nurse practitioner.
Last question, Mr. Chairman.
Senator.
So as you look at some of the foreign medical graduates that are out there and they kick ECFMG or whatever it is, that they're from Canada, they can still carry on their nursing license?
Reciprocity with Canada? Did you want to answer that? I heard you inhale.
Through the chair, Senator Olson. This bill actually repeals the language relating to licensing endorsement for nurses completing the Canadian Nurses Association testing. So this bill repeals that endorsement,
but
along with foreign nursing schools to receive temporary permits.
The question I have, though, is that a person that's already licensed with a foreign, that's a foreign medical graduate, they can continue on being licensed as they always have been. Is that correct? They just can't get new licensees? Is that what I'm hearing you say?
You're asking about foreign medical licensees.
Well,
do you mean foreign nursing? Foreign nursing licensees. You know, a couple of the provinces in Canada now take the NCLEX exam, the National Council exam. And so that would be a question to ask the Executive Director of the Board of Nursing, who is online and could answer that question in detail.
Senator Giesel, following up on Senator Olson's question, does the bill do anything that would prevent that from happening?
Yes, there are aspects of it. First of all, we have had in statute a provision that licensed practical nurses who were foreign graduates could get a temporary license for 6 months prior to taking the exam. And this is being updated to actually remove that. What we found is that about 42% of the folks that take our licensing exam who are foreign licensed nurses actually can't pass it. And so why would we give them a six-month temporary license? We require that they take the licensing exam first, get the background check done, and then are fully licensed.
Okay. Senator Machicki.
How'd you know I had a question, Mr. Chairman?
And read your mind.
But I do. And this is for a separate issue. I'm very supportive of the bill. One of my constituents is concerned that apparently, and this may not be a discussion for this bill, but apparently it takes two separate criminal history record checks in order for someone to become qualified, even as a CNA. And a lot of the medical facilities are really struggling with that requirement. It takes time, and you have to wait for the results of one before you send out for the second. CNAs are sometimes sort of fluid. It's tough to fill a lot of those positions because of that. And I don't know if you might entertain a change under this bill or you think it's something we should do separately, but do you have any comments about that problem?
Thank you, through the chair, Senator Machicki. In your board packet, under memos, correspondence, they have the very same tabs as we do, am I correct?
Maybe not.
Maybe not. Okay. It is a letter dated February 11th, 2014, and it has bold yellow highlighting on it. And this is from the Executive Administrator of the Board of Nursing.
And does it say?
You don't have it.
Is it Nancy Sanders or no?
Yes, it is. Yes, I think you
February 28th, 2014?
Yeah, not.
It's a different letter. Yeah.
Why do they not have it?
No, that's not true.
Okay.
Well.
Okay. All right. First of all, we are in a bit of a do loop with the FBI. Senator Machicki, through the chair.
Excuse me. A what?
A computer do loop, you know, when it keeps going around and around.
Thank you.
So I'm going to guess it was probably about 07 or 08 that, to the surprise of the Board of Nursing, the Department of Health and Human Services enacted statutes which required background checks for anyone working in a Medicaid-providing facility. And that, of course, includes CNAs. It had to be an FBI background check. They also established barrier crimes. In other words, if you had certain felonies, you would not be employable. All right. The Board of Nursing has a background check, but the FBI will not allow the results of the Board of Nursing's FBI background check to be shared with anyone else, any other facility. This is a federal law, and vice versa. So if the facility did a federal background check, they were prohibited from sharing it with anyone else. In addition, Health and Human Services, Health and Social Services established, like I said, these barrier crimes. The Board of Nursing has no barrier crimes to practicing at any level of nursing. It's evaluated on an individual basis. Again, Nancy Sanders, Executive Administrator, is on the phone and would be able to answer that specific question perhaps more robustly than I just did.
Okay.
Yes, that's it. Yep, all that yellow.
Senator Machicki was pointing to a memo.
Yes, the memo of February. It's actually a letter, February 11th, 2014, directed to Barbara Jacobson, Chief Executive, Nurse Executive at YK Health Corporation.
We're going to have an opportunity for more questions here in just a moment, but at this point, I'd like to remove my objection. Is there any further objection to adopting this version? Seeing none, version Y is adopted as the working document. So we'll continue with questions from members of the committee, because we do have folks that want to testify. Any questions at this stage?
Well, Mr. Chairman, is this the time I would ask a question of Ms. Sanders, or should I wait until after public testimony? Your choice.
You can ask it now, Senator.
Okay.
Ms. Sanders is on the phone. She's the executive administrator.
Let me get to that. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. That's right. So, Nancy Sanders from Anchorage, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
So we have a, can you please state your name and who you affiliate with for the record, because we do have a question for you from Senator Machicki.
Yes, my name is Nancy Sanders. I'm the Executive Administrator for the Board of Nursing, and that's in CBPL, Corporations Business and Professional Licensing.
Thank you. Are you ready to field a question from the senators?
Yes.
Thank you, Senator Machicki.
Hello, Dr. Sanders. So I think you probably heard my question. I've read some of your, I kind of scanned your response to Ms. Jacobson. So it's not a Board of Nursing rule. It's an FBI requirement. What can we do to streamline that double or that second background check?
Well, where it becomes an issue is why you require the background check. And the Board of Nursing is requiring the background check for licensing. So unless the other facilities or even the other state agencies are using that information for licensing, the Board of Nursing can't share it. And I checked this out again because I know there's many, many questions about that. I checked it out with an FBI representative who's going to be coming in May to do an audit of the Board of Nursing. So I don't know how to answer more positively.
Senator Machicki.
Well, perhaps a follow-up question for you. Is there, could you conceive of a method, Dr. Sanders, of separating the CNA requirements from the general nursing requirements? I think, you know, although they're both imperative to the success of a medical institution, one has a lower level of responsibilities and training requirements. Is there a possibility to lower the background check requirements of the CNA, which seems to be the position that is the most difficult to retain?
Senator, through the chair, that has not been the experience with the Board of Nursing regulating CNAs. And the reason I say that is because CNAs are intimately involved with people they care for, including in their homes. And since it's the mission of the Board of Nursing to protect the public, it's all, you know, it's even more of an issue for the CNA versus other licensing categories. I might, you know, I might also just clarify that getting the background check does not prevent the applicant for CNA from practicing. They, after they have passed the exam, the license and the certification exam, they are issued a temporary permit while the background check is received, and temporary permit is good for 6 months. So although they have to submit fingerprints when they apply, that does not prevent them from working on a temporary permit.
Okay. Thank you.
Any additional questions at this stage for Ms. Sanders? Ms. Sanders, do you have any other additional testimony you'd like to give to us since you're online?
Not at this time. I certainly am open to other questions.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to move on to some other folks that are also online. So I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly. Laura Saccone or Saccone?
Saccone.
Please state your name for the record, and if you've got testimony, please present it, and we may have some questions from the senators to ask you.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Laura Saccone. I am a certified nurse midwife, and I represent the Alaska Advanced Practice Registered Nurse Alliance. The APRN Alliance is a professional coalition of the four advanced practice nursing organizations in the state and represents the nearly 800 nurse practitioners, nurse midwives, nurse anesthetists, and clinical nurse specialists licensed in Alaska. I'm here to voice our support for SB 166, in particular section 08.68.010 subsection 3, which designates, as Senator Giesel referenced earlier, one seat on the Board of Nursing to an advanced nurse practitioner. We believe that designation contributes positively to the ongoing communication and cooperation between the Board of Nursing and the regulated community of advanced practice nurses. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from Senator Olson?
Mr. Cohen, I was wondering, where do you practice your nursing, your midwife?
I'm a full-time nurse midwife at South Central Foundation, and I delivered two babies at the Alaska Native Medical Center last night.
Have you ever practiced out in rural Alaska?
I have not.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any additional questions at this point? Okay, thank you. So we're going to move now to is it Janice Shockman? Are you online?
Hello, this is Janice Shockman.
Hi, please state your name again for the record, who you affiliate with, and begin your testimony.
My name is Janice Shockman, and I am president of the Alaska Nurses Association, and I'm calling in today to testify on behalf of the Nurses Association in support of Senate Bill 166. The Nurses Association does appreciate that this is something that the Board of Nursing has needed for a while, and we are fully in support of that. We're also very fully in support of the formal designation of having an advanced practice nurse seat on the board. If you have any questions at this time for me, I'd be happy to answer them.
Questions from members of the committee? Not at this time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, we have Beth Farnstrom. Beth, are you on the phone?
Yes, I'm here.
Could you please state your name again for the record, who you're affiliated with, and begin your testimony?
Yes. For the record, my name is Beth Farnstrom. I am the chair of the Board of Nursing. SB 166 is the result of many hours and years of discussion by the members of the Board of Nursing and is fully supported by the board. I've been a member of the Board of Nursing for 7 years, and the board has discussed these changes my entire tenure. At its January 2014 meeting, The board voted unanimously to work with the legislature on this issue. The motion passed with all the members in support. And I'll take any questions if you have at this time, and I will stay on the line while you discuss this bill.
Thank you. Questions for members of the committee? Seeing none at this time. We also have, again, Don seems to be a regular here, Don Hamburger, as well as Gray Mitchell. If those folks want to come forward, state their name for the record, we may have questions for members of the committee.
You first. For the record, my name is Don Hamburger. I'm Director of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. There is one issue that I would like to talk to the committee about. It is Section 3, Page 3, Line 14 and 15. Now, I promised...
That's Section 3.
Section 3.
Page 3.
Page 3.
And this is the CS that we've adopted, or excuse me.
Oh, I don't have the CS in my packet. I'm working off original, so.
So we're on version Y. Version Y. I've gone to the page. No, you just gave it to him.
Thank you, Senator, for that copy. It is Section 3, okay. Page 3. Lines 14 and 15.
Okay.
In version Y.
Okay.
And as I was saying, I promised Madam Chair that I would make certain the committee understood that this is a division perspective, and it has to do with flexibility. The current version asks for a master's degree in nursing, and the division does see some challenges, potential challenges, I should say, in that. We would like to see if we can maintain it at a registered nurse degree. The challenges that we experienced recently is the Board of Public Accountancy. Not long ago, the statutes were changed, and in those statutes, they required a CPA degree and accounting experience. When we were looking for that position, to fill that position, it took us about 6 months, perhaps a little bit longer, and it also took us three postings, some nationwide, to try to find somebody with a CPA degree to fill that position. Ultimately, we could not find it. The division's perspective is flexibility. We believe, as Dr. Nancy Sanders is fully qualified, she has the degree. The division, when we go out for an applicant pool, can certainly choose a master's or a doctor's without it being in statute. So we'd like the committee to consider that flexibility and consider leaving it as a registered nurse, giving the division and the Board of Nursing the opportunity to look for the most qualified. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hamburger, as you look at it now, how many masters in nursing do we have in the state of Alaska? Do you have any idea?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I don't know how many masters we have. I know we have 15,000 nurses,
sure.
So I think the applicant pool is there.
And then how many PhDs in nursing do we have, do you know?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I only know one, Dr. Sanders.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Questions from other members of the committee?
I have one.
Senator Machicki?
I think I'll probably wait for the sponsor to come back. I
mean, okay.
If I can just make a statement. I mean, clearly they've increased the competence of the entire board in the bill. I think that's a very good thing. And I'll just wait till the sponsor comes back to see. Perhaps she can explain why she feels that level of competence is important for the administrator position as well.
Yeah, we'll call up Senator Giesel just in a moment. Mr. Hamburger, any additional comments you wish to make at this point?
Mr. Chairman, no. Thank you.
Mr. Mitchell?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Gray Mitchell. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. The one section of the bill that affects the Department of Labor in the CS is Section 15 on page 7 and page 8. And this section of the bill essentially assigns the Department of Labor the authority to impose a civil penalty of up to $10,000 for a person who knowingly violates a provision of the statutory provision that essentially limits an employer from discharging, threatening, or otherwise discriminating against a nurse who is asked to delegate their duty to another employee or another worker and refuses to do so, and also protects a person who those duties are attempted to be delegated to. The Department of Labor does have a program where we pursue similar protections for workers who are discriminated against because they bring forward an occupational safety and health complaint. But this is really the only area that we investigate at this point in terms of this whistleblower retaliation kind of complaint. And so one of our concerns is whether or not it would be best for the Department of Labor to be the one to investigate this. We really wouldn't be able to use our existing investigator, which is partially funded under federal funds through the U.S. Department of Labor's Occupational Safety and Health Administration, to do this kind of work. We have had some preliminary discussions with the sponsor to try and get a handle on how often this really happens, and it sounds like it's fairly minimal. So, you know, we may be able to address it with existing staff just with a little bit of extra training, but it is a concern of ours.
Thank you. Questions of Mr. Mitchell by members of the committee. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Mitchell, as you look at investigations and people trying to keep their license and keep it whole because that's the most valuable thing that they own, how do you expect the Department of Labor to go ahead and investigate a nurse that's under suspicion as opposed to the regular channels of investigation that they go through now? What's the advantage that the DOL has over the other investigation process that happens now?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I don't know the investigation process that exists now. I assume that if a nurse has some issue with their license, that it goes through a process with the Board of Nursing, but I can't speak to that.
Sure. Well, so you don't see any advantage for what you essentially want as an amendment to this bill? Because I don't hear an advantage to it.
Through the chair, I think it's an issue for the sponsor, I think, to address that.
Well, the sponsor's written the bill the way she wants it, and I don't see why you're opposing it.
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I don't say that I'm opposing it. I'm merely voicing it as a concern.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Just to follow up, from your perspective, the current concern has obviously risen to a level for you to want to testify on it, but is it an issue that you see would, in your opinion, would prevent the bill from moving forward?
Mr. Chairman, I don't see that, no.
Okay. Any additional questions for the gentleman at the they're testifying right now? No, thank you. Thank you very much. Would the sponsor like to come back up, please? So, Senator, there has been two issues raised that if you would like to address them, you have time, and then we'll ask you some questions. Can you please restate who you are for the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Senator Kathy Giesel, District N. The first question has to do with Section 3, which is found on page 3 of Version Y, and has to do with the minimum requirement of a master's degree in nursing for the executive administrator. The Board of Nursing regulates approximately 17,000 licensees. That's actually over 25% of the licensed professionals in the state, so it's a massive number of licensees. But the executive administrator does more than that. The Board of Nursing actually delegates to the administrator the authority to review license applications. This is different, for example, than the Board of Medicine. That board reviews every application by the board themselves. The Board of Nursing delegates that because of the large volume of applications and licensees. So the executive administrator reviews board or license applications. She also reviews the initial complaints as they come in. So someone, you, for example, Mr. Chairman, call in and say, this nurse did this bad thing. The executive administrator is delegated the authority to review that and determine if it rises to the level of an investigation. That's additional authority that most other boards do not give. The executive director has to be fully versed in the practice of nursing on the ground in all levels. We regulate, the Board of Nursing regulates from a high school diploma all the way up to a doctorally prepared person. Now, there was question about what the possible pool of applicants would be for this position. I've sat twice on interview panels for this position, and I can tell you we had at least a dozen people apply in those two interview opportunities. So there's a number of master's prepared nurses. A nurse advanced nurse practitioner has to have at minimum a master's degree, and there's about 500 of them in the state. There are numerous doctorally prepared nurses. In fact, more and more, as nurse practitioners now, level of entry rises to the doctoral level. So there is an adequate pool of applicants.
Questions? Senator Chicky.
Just to have a, Madam Chair, master's. So an RN program typically now is a four-year degree or five-year in some cases, right? Pretty challenging degree these days.
An RN degree.
You have to get close and speak up. Sorry.
Through the chair, Ms. Senator Machicki, an RN degree varies. It can be a two-year degree or a four. There is encouragement that it go to a four-year baccalaureate degree. You're correct.
And the question I was getting to, is there a one-year program between an RN four-year degree with a RN to a master's degree in nursing?
There actually are bridge programs like that now. The University of Alaska Anchorage program is a four-year baccalaureate and a two-year master's degree.
Thank you.
So, you're upping the qualifications for this this individual position, and you don't believe it's going to be difficult in finding capable candidates from a preferred pool.
Having been in an interview process twice, Mr. Chair, no, I don't think we'd have a problem.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Machicki.
Just to comment, Madam Chair, or Madam Chair, I'm so used to serving another committee with her. But, Senator Giesel, I like the fact that you've increased the requirements for the board. I think it's a very challenging line of work. I'm certainly going to support a master's degree at a minimum. I trust in the board's ability to choose how their board should be led and the level of qualifications they need, so I'm fine with it.
Thank you. Senator, did you start off your testimony by saying this was a simple bill?
Yes.
Okay.
I still contend that it is. And, Mr. Chair, there was also a question about
on
the whistleblower.
Page 8, line 20, there was an issue raised. Do you want to comment on that issue, please?
What I'm going to suggest, Mr. Chair, that let's ask, first of all, the executive administrator can speak to this because she worked with the Assistant Attorney General from law to write this section, and they are the ones that encouraged that, in fact, it should go under Labor and Workforce Development. In addition, the Alaska Nurses Association strongly endorsed this segment of the bill. So perhaps if you could ask Dr. Sanders, and then I believe it was Laura Sarcone, and I'm forgetting the Janice Shockman is the ANA president.
Okay, so who do you think out of the three should we go to first?
Why don't you start with Janice?
Janice, is Senator Dunleavy, are you still on the phone?
Yes, I'm here, sir.
Could you please talk to, we're on page 8 of the version Y of the bill, and it's line 20, it starts at 19, goes to 21, that talks about labor and workforce development. Do you want to comment on that?
Sure. We very strongly supported this whistleblower protection language in the bill. If I may provide an example of why we believe this is important. I personally am an intensive care nurse. I have specialty certifications in critical care and cardiac surgery. I am very experienced in my chosen specialty. However, if my employer decided that they were short-staffed in the obstetrics department and wanted me to go down and work a shift down there, for me to do that would actually probably be dangerous to a patient. My only training in obstetrics was very generalized training in nursing school 17 years ago. And so this language would protect me from any kind of punitive or retaliatory actions by my employer if I can say to him or to her, my employer, that this is an unsafe assignment and I refuse to take it. And so we do believe that it is also important that there be some sort of penalty in a civil action if the employer knowingly violates this and forces or attempts to force a nurse to take an assignment that they are not trained for.
Thank you. Questions from members of the committee? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you look at some of the smaller hospitals where you have a limited amount of nursing, what kind of a attitude is this going to breed amongst the nurses there, where you've got you're the only trained nurse that may be on duty, and all you've got are LPNs and the like that are there?
If I may.
Yes, sure. Please.
You're the one I'm asking.
Okay, through the chair. There is a section in the bill, if you would look up on line 13 of section 16 on page 8, the nurse must report the improper attempt to assign or delegate the task to the board, and then it is up to the board to determine whether or not the assignment was improper. And so, you know, this is not just a nurse being able to say, sorry, I don't want to do it or I don't feel like it today. This is a matter of public safety. And ultimately, it would be the board's decision on whether or not the assignment was improper.
So, with all due respect, ma'am, I would say that the person that would be scared of telling somebody or asking somebody to go down to another ward or another facility, they'd be in danger of being afraid of that if there's this kind of civil penalty that's there, though, so that I see them that they would be hesitant to send somebody down there, and therefore nobody would go down there to help either OB or if you're on a medicine floor or a post-surgical floor.
Through the chair, I would also like to respond that, you know, nursing occurs in various environments, and the senator is talking about, say, a small rural hospital. I have experience working in a 58-bed hospital in Oregon, and in that hospital, frankly, nurses are a little less specialized, and, you know, when I worked in that hospital, I was oriented and trained to work in different areas of the hospital, and, you know, it's very hard to say that, you know, a nurse can say, oh, I just don't feel like doing this today, as opposed to putting the nurse in a position of having to take an assignment that actually puts the patient in danger. Am I making my point?
I hear what you're trying to say, and if you have a bigger facility, I can understand the concern that you have there, but I'm dealing with some of the smaller facilities where you've got nursing shortages that are out there, especially in rural Alaska, where I've been practicing with 10 or 12 beds that are there, and you're saying that somebody can't be assigned to an area just because they don't want to go down there, or it's inconvenient for them. I find this a disservice to the nursing administration that might be in that hospital. And that they would be in danger of, quote-unquote, putting somebody in harm's way because somebody was not there. And I would say that that may not be indeed be the case, because if you're the only nurse or one of the few nurses that's on that night in a hospital, you are the best person to go down there because you have at least had seen some of the scenarios that have transpired, even though it was way back in nursing training, as opposed to somebody who's got nobody there, or for God's sake, if you just have just a health aide that's there, and they have not even seen those issues that are out there. And you're putting that administrator in danger of having a $10,000 fine because they sent somebody down there because they didn't want to? That's where I see the problem.
Senator Giesel, would you like to respond or add?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Olson, you have a very strong point that I completely agree with. And I would point you to this section, which starts even on the previous page. Section 15 starts on the previous page. There's a three-part phase to this. The nurse alleges that the task is not delegatable because the person to whom the task was delegated was not properly trained to perform the task. I'm looking at 8. Oh, you know what? I'm on the wrong version. That's not helpful, is it? It's the three sections. Let's see. It's on page 8, and I'm looking at line 13. No, wait a second. You're right. Sorry, I was in the wrong version. It starts on page 7, line 27, whistleblower protection. And on page 8, it says that the discharge threat or discrimination. Starting on page line 1, pardon me, on line 1, page 8. The discharge threat or discrimination was based on the nurse's refusal to perform a task or assignment that was not within the scope of practice of the nurse. Okay, so this is an LPN. They're being reassigned to the critical care unit where they have to administer IV medications, and this is outside their scope. Okay, so clearly this would be something they could object to. Perform a task or assignment that the nurse has not been educated to perform. Again, yikes. If I'm working in critical care and I'm being sent to neonatal intensive care, neurology unit, that's going to be outside what I'm necessarily educated to do. Delegate a task that the board finds not delegatable. So this is the board evaluating. There's an evaluation process here. Was this something the nurse should have been able to do? To go from med-surg to OB, of course. Right? The point that you made, you're better than nobody being there. You know how to take vital signs. You know what to look for. You were educated in nursing school in OB. So the board would not find that not delegatable. Delegate a task to an individual has not been properly educated to perform the task. And the board finds that it's the task is not delegatable. With all due respect to you as a physician, Senator Olson, physicians sometimes will ask nurses to do things that are not delegatable functions. So again, perhaps do a cut down to insert an IV. You know, nurses are not typically an RN on a typical floor would not be qualified to do that. So there's a four points to this, and it's not really that the nurse just didn't feel like doing it. They've set some sidebars around it.
Senator
Giesel, my issue with it though is that you've got an administrator that's out there that's trying to go ahead and provide health care in rural Alaska, and if you have somebody there that's delegated, the administrator, the director of nursing in that facility, may be hesitant because she realizes that if she, and you know, let's face it, hospitals are intensely, there's a lot of intensity that's there because life and death is on the line, and because of that people get frazzled, people get tired, people get stressed, and that's why we have laws in there. But because of that, the human element comes in where people don't necessarily get along. And because one person doesn't get along with another one, or somebody's trying to usurp their authority, how do we make sure that that administrator, that DON that's out there, doesn't feel like she's liable for a $10,000 fine if she has somebody that she doesn't necessarily get along with, tries to assign them to something because she's scared of having a whistleblower action on her? That's where I'm having my problem.
Senator Olson, through the chair, incredibly valid concern. I agree with you. Mm-hmm. I believe Ms. Shockman pointed out that in small rural hospitals, typically nurses are more generalists versus Providence or Alaska Regional and Anchorage, where they're very highly specialized. Mm-hmm. And so you're right. Sometimes those issues arise. But again, remember the board will be looking at this complaint, too, before it goes forward to actual penalty. And the board is very diverse. We always have tried in the past to have someone who actually practices in rural Alaska. In fact, we had a community health aide from Nurvik on the board for many years when I was there, and they present that, they bring that balance to the board. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So there's a couple areas. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Senator.
I guess that's one of my point that I was wondering about and didn't raise the question, is that you've got a board there that's looking at a complaint. And as you look at the reservations on Section 3 about having a master's degree in nursing, many of those people that have, many of those nurses that have a master's degree are younger, they're more ambitious, and many times they don't have the long-term practical experience of being out in the bush and having been, or being out in the bush and being elsewhere and having that, been in those crisis situations where the wrong decision was made at times, or the right decision was made at times, or a more right decision was made. And I see that somebody like that doesn't necessarily have that breadth of practice out where, you know, where the rubber hits the road, because they've been in academia all their life trying to get a master's degree so they could get to the position of the the director or the executive administrator. I guess that's the reservation that I identify with Mr. Hobbiger related to the occupational license. Because the board, or because people on the board have never been. And then the one person I asked, she's the director of whatever it was, had never been in rural Alaska. And that's where I have my reservations, I guess. Ease my reservations, if you could.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Through the chair. First of all, Section 3 on page 3 refers to the executive administrator of the board. This is the person that's there day to day. So let's say a complaint came in, a whistleblower type complaint went in. Because these are so rare, the executive administrator would take this directly to the Board of Nursing. The board composition is found, it's right at the beginning. Yeah, I figured it was probably near the beginning. There we go. It's in Section 1. So one person will be a licensed practical nurse. Okay, so you got an LPN. Now, typically LPNs work in long-term care facilities, right? And that could be in rural or urban Alaska. Number two, a registered nurse engaged in nursing education, and we've broadened it here. They can either be graduate, baccalaureate, or associate degree. In the past, we've required baccalaureate. There's only one school that does a baccalaureate program right now, and so it limited the applicants. But here's a nurse educator. Nurse educators have to have a very broad perspective.
So they've got
That's the second number.
They've got the 4-year degree.
They would have a 4-year degree, likely, yes, to teach in any of these programs. The third person on the board would be an advanced nurse practitioner. Advanced nurse practitioners, a lot of us have practiced in rural Alaska. Okay, so that's the third member. Then you've got two other members who are registered nurses at large. Okay, so two more. Those are RNs at large. Mm-hmm. Typically, again, one or more of those have been in rural Alaska. And the last one, the last two members to make up that seven-member board are two persons who have who are public members. They have no direct interest in the healthcare industry. Now, that's where we had a retired community health aide. We've had LPNs from Nome on the board before. The geographic distribution is something the board is very attentive to. So you have a very diverse board, and they would look at that kind of whistleblower complaint from a rural community in a very broad way, understanding the real situation of what it's like to practice there, just as you've pointed out.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So questions at this point? So there's a couple issues that have been brought up to, and we've vetted them, and we have a little bit of time to also think through them as we between now and the next reading of the bill. But just maybe some things to think about and talk with folks about when you come back to present again. We'll see where it goes.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Schicke.
And I just want to point out that whistleblower protection, that section was repealed and reenacted. There was a whistleblower section in the original code. There was a 24-hour requirement for reporting versus 72. It dealt with tasks that were improperly delegated. This just gave it some teeth, gave the ability to bring civil action and the potential civil penalty. But it's not, the whistleblower protection is not new in the code. It was existing. So
Thank you, Senator Machicki. That is absolutely correct, through the chair.
Thank you. At this point, we're going to open up public testimony. Is there anyone online that wishes to testify that has not testified yet? Nobody online? Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify upon this bill that has not testified yet? Seeing none, we're going to keep public testimony open. Are there any further comments or questions on this bill? We're going to hold this bill through at least for another hearing. Any questions or comments? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Giesel, you talked about the 17,000 licensees that are licensed remind me of what all the other licensees are. They, like the medical board has got the PAs, the paramedics, and those kind of things. What all categories do you have underneath that?
We have certified nurse aides, so they're the people we were talking about earlier, typically practice in long-term care facilities, typically in rural Alaska, lots of training programs around the state. We have licensed practical nurses, not quite so many of those anymore, but they also practice commonly in long-term care facilities and hospitals. We have registered nurses, which of course are across the board, schools, etc. Advanced nurse practitioners is the fourth category.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. So with that, we're going to set the bill aside. We appreciate it. And we're going to take a one-minute brief at ease to prepare for the next bill, which is going to be SB 167, sponsored by Senator Huggins. So brief at ease until we get change over here. We're back in session. We're now hearing Bill 167, sponsored by Senator Huggins. This is the first hearing on the bill. Presenting the bill will be Ashton Compton, staff to Senator Huggins. So, Ashton, please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ashton Compton, staff to Senator Charlie Huggins. Before you today is SB 167, version A, a bill aimed at addressing an unintended loophole in Alaska statute that is harmful to consumers of uninsured, underinsured motorist insurance, also known as UUIN. With a couple of simple changes to the language, the statute will be made consistent with its intent, which was to limit UUIN stacking. It will resolve an inconsistency that unfairly and unnecessarily forces consumers to purchase insurance they do not desire or need. Alaska restricts the combining or stacking of multiple UUIM coverages when consumers insure multiple vehicles under one policy with the same insurer. Coverage cannot be combined or stacked. Instead, coverage is limited to the highest coverage on any one of the vehicles. This makes the coverage more affordable, improves consumer choice, and enhances predictability. In 1990, language was adopted and later applied that created an unintended loophole that is inconsistent with the intent of limiting stacking and subsequently harms consumer choice and predictability. Under current language, if a consumer insures multiple vehicles under separate policies from the same insurer, stacking is only limited for the named insured, which commonly is a person who purchased the policy. But for all other persons, all coverages for all the vehicles must be stacked, which is illogical, inconsistent, and unnecessarily increases the cost of insurance. An example of this was provided in your committee packet. You guys have this. With the simple clarification, SB 167 will protect insurance rates, consumer choice, and predictability under all policy forms as originally intended. With that, Mr. Chairman, I would like to invite Sheldon Winters from State Farm to join me to explain the law and the impact of the bill.
Mr. Winters, would you like to come forward, state your name for the record, and be prepared to testify?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Sheldon Winters. I'm here on behalf of State Farm Insurance Company. I want to thank the sponsor, Senator Huggins, and the co-sponsor for moving this legislation. This has been a problem in Alaska for several years, and we're glad it's finally being addressed. Ashton Compton did a fantastic job, so I'll try to add a little bit of detail and a little bit of background here, but I know your time is precious, and I'll try to be brief. What I'd like to address is, first of all, what this bill doesn't do and what it does do. with your indulgence, maybe a two-minute everything you wanted to know and not know about uninsured motorist coverage and stacking, and then a little bit about the bill and just wrap up.
Go for it.
All right. So this bill is not, in our from our perspective, about the merits of stacking and whether stacking should or should not be allowed in Alaska. Our legislature decided that twice already in 1984 and 1990. This bill is simply about enforcing that public policy that was adopted and making sure that it's consistently and entirely applied, and that's the loophole that Ashton had referred to. Give you a little bit of background, a little bit of history about uninsured motorist coverage. In 1984, Alaska adopted mandatory liability insurance. An interesting side note about that is the insurance industry was somewhat concerned and a little bit skeptical about that. And the reason was simply that there was a false impression that with mandatory liability insurance, that was going to cure the uninsured driver situation. Well, history showed back then and it showed since then that that's just not the case. We got a problem in this state and throughout the country with uninsured drivers and underinsured drivers. I think the stat in Alaska is about 13 to 15% of the people out there are completely uninsured. So in response to that problem, that even with the mandatory liability insurance, we're still going to have underinsured drivers and uninsured drivers, the industry actually proposed in 1984 that the legislature mandate uninsured motorist coverage. With that, consumers now can go out and buy their own insurance and make sure that they're protected at a certain level of coverage. Lots of people find that very important. I know I do. It's an important part of every family's insurance package to the extent they take advantage of it. One major challenge of that is to keep that coverage affordable, because when you think about it, what you're doing is you're insuring somebody we know nothing about out there. We do know one thing, they're not insured. So what, how you keep that insurance affordable is basically you preclude it from being stacked. So what is stacking? Stacking is simply when you have multiple coverages on multiple vehicles, it's combining them or stacking them to add extra coverage. And I think I'll give you the best way I can explain this is with respect to liability insurance, because we all have a better handle on that. I'm going to use the example of my family because I think it's typical. I have my wife and I have my two teenage kids. And I have four cars in the family. I choose to provide a certain amount of liability coverage on each one of those cars. And with my children, it's a minimum amount of liability because they're darn expensive. It's $50,000. If they're involved in an accident, there's $50,000 of liability coverage for that accident that applies. If stacking was required, which means all four of my cars, the liability coverage applies, the coverage would be $200,000 per accident. I couldn't buy $50,000 coverage. I'd have to buy $200,000 of coverage. It would be very expensive. And it's something that I choose not to do. The same concept applies for uninsured motorist coverage, basically. We should be able to choose a select amount of coverage applicable to any one of our vehicles and not have stacking. And by precluding stacking, we keep that coverage cost down and we allow myself to pick the amount of coverage I want on any particular vehicle. So in 1984, when we adopted mandated uninsured motorist coverage, the legislature made it clear stacking was not allowed. And there's a letter in your file where I actually have the statute quoted in there, and I won't bother you with it right now, but it's important at this point in time because it kind of goes to the heart and soul of this statute to point out that if you have multiple vehicles in your household, you can insure them, depending on the company you go to, in one of two ways. Some companies will require them to be insured under one policy, and that's called what we call a multi-car policy. Some companies, State Farm is one of them, does it the other way, where each vehicle has a separate policy, and we call those single car policies. In 1984, when the legislature said we are not going to allow stacking, it specifically addressed, recognized that that's an accepted way, both ways is an accepted way of doing business. Consumers have their choice which way they want to go. And the statute in 1984 specifically precluded stacking for both situations. I actually mentioned in 1990 there was a problem. In 1990, the statutes were completely revised. primarily to the benefit of the consumers. The mandated coverage were expanded. Now insurers had to offer 50 at various levels, I think 250, 300, 500, all the way up to $1 million, which gave consumers more choice. There were a lot more provisions enacted in 1990, but the bottom line is that the whole purpose was to give consumer more choice, more predictability, so they could buy the coverage they wanted, and have knowledge in knowing exactly what they were purchasing. Again, in 1990, our legislature made it clear we were not going to allow stacking. I think in my letter in there that kind of outlines the legislative history, and I'll try to be very brief here, but it's probably easiest to just look at the Senate Bill 167. When the legislation in 1990 went to the Senate floor, it only addressed anti-stacking for the multi-car policy, and that's in the bill. The language in the statute is Section 1, Line 6. It's the very first sentence, and that's what we're generally calling the anti-stacking for, and it basically says for a multi-car policy. It did not have any language addressing the single-car policy situation. That omission was caught. I attached in my letter that's in your file the actual legislative intent. It couldn't be any more clear in our mind. It's actually a written legislative intent. And basically that intent says that stacking should not be allowed for the single-car policy, and we want to make sure that single-car policies are treated exactly like multi-car policies.
Ms. Blunters?
Yes.
Are there any questions from members of the committee?
No.
Do you understand the bill?
Yeah.
Okay. No, I'm just saying, we have two more bills to hear in 50, 20 minutes.
I got it.
So
I can wrap up?
Yeah, please.
I will. The language has been looked at and approved by the Division of Insurance. I think the best way I can sum all this up is there are, I think, 42 states that do not allow stacking at all. Alaska's one of them. There are 8 states that allow some form of stacking, and I think it's my understanding that in those states, their uninsured motorist coverage rates are about twice as the states that preclude stacking. That's the concern. The consumers are paying too much, and they don't need to. This discrepancy is not in either state statute because there's no reason for it, and that's what we're asking to be fixed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Questions for the testifiers at this point? Presenters, I should say. Okay, thank you. Do we have Kent and Brian online?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm here.
Kenton, are you online to answer any questions from the committee, or do you have a presentation?
I was just going to briefly add a word of support for the bill, but I'm available for questions, too, if anyone has any.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Brian online? Mr. Brian is with Property Casualty Insurance Association out of Olympia, Washington. Questions for members of the committee? Seeing none at this point, is there a Cynthia Lamar online?
Cynthia? Yes, I'm here. Thank you.
And Cynthia, are you here to field questions or to testify on behalf of the bill?
I'm here, happy to answer questions. I'm representing Horace Mann Insurance Company in support of the bill.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Ms. Lamar?
Just a comment. I read your letter and appreciate your helping us understand this bill, Ms. Lamar.
That's Senator Machicki.
Thank you.
Mr. Hester, are you here to testify or just answer any questions that we may have? Do we have any questions at this point for Mr. Hester? Seeing none, we're going to open up public testimony. Is there anyone online that would like to testify other than the folks that we just mentioned? No one. Anyone else in the audience that would like to testify at this moment? No one. We're going to leave public testimony open. Any questions before we set this bill aside for members of the committee?
I have one question for the bill sponsor.
Senator Olson, the bill sponsor, is the bill sponsor still here? Please come forward, state your name for the record one more time.
For the record, my name is Ashton Compton.
Ms. Compton, was there a problem with the people of within the state of Alaska, that the drivers in particular, that caused this to come to the forefront, or is it something that was just seen by the insurance company that's having a problem that was there from the anti-stacking that happened in 1984 and 1990?
I think it's both. I think consumers were concerned with it, and then also insurers as well.
So you had complaints to your office from consumers? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much. So at this point, we're going to leave public testimony open, set the bill aside, and we'll pick it up at a future meeting. We're now going to move to SB 189. This is a bill by the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. This is the first hearing on the bill. Presenting the bill will be Steve Ritchie, staff to Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. Mr. Ritchie. Mr. Ritchie, please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Steve Ritchie, staff of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. With the chairman's permission, I can provide you a brief overview
please.
Of Senate Bill 189.
Please.
Senate Bill 189 has been introduced by the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee to resolve an issue with AS 0818161, which defines the qualifications for an exemption from contractor licensing. The issue is that there is a growing number of people who are abusing exemptions currently defined by statute, which provide an opportunity for people to act as their own general contractor without a license. Commonly called the owner-builder exemption, which is meant to allow people to build their own homes, a duplex, triplex, or fourplex, or a commercial building without getting a contractor's license. No one wants to prevent Alaskans from the freedom to act as their own general contractor to build on their own. But with the way the exemption is worded in AS 0818161, there is a growing number of people who are operating contractor businesses while avoiding getting licensed, bonded, and insured. If you look at the language in Senate Bill 189, Section 1, Subsection 12, which starts on page 2, line 26, you will see that we are trying to add language to the exemption that limits the use of this exemption as a means to build homes intended to be sold. The situation now is that current law creates an unenforceable law for someone who says, this new home is for me, that new home is for my wife, that new home is for my son, that new home is for my mother, etc. They're literally examples where rows of new homes under construction with for sale signs hung in the front of them are being built under the guise of this exemption. A home built by an unlicensed builder means that the buyer doesn't have the same protection of a home built by a licensed contractor with the proper bonding and insurance. The legal recourse is significantly reduced for the purchaser. This bill is the priority of the Alaska State Home Builders Association. It ensures protection for consumers and strengthens compliance with the intent of existing statute. In your packet, you will find several support letters. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have. We also have Al Nagel and Gray Mitchell, who are from the Department of Labor, who can speak to some of the more technical aspects of the bill.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Ritchie? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is there opposition to this bill at all?
Senator Olson, through the chair, in your packet you will find there is one letter of opposition from Castle Stone. I believe it's a masonry outfit from Fairbanks. And you're certainly entitled to read it.
Sure.
They make reference to the monopolistic nature of contractors. However, existing statute does provide for contractor licensing, and that is the intent. I would say, unless you're going to strip all of the contractor licensing from statute, it is probably best that we enforce them.
Well, as you look at the, Mr. Senator, if I can continue.
Yes.
If you look at the Alaska home builders, it sounds like somebody that's trying to go and stack themselves and make it so that they're the monopolistic entity that's out there to protect their members. And that's what the intent of this bill is, what it appears to be. Is that true? I mean,
Senator Olson, through the chair, we want to ensure that the intent of the current statute is followed. It really is. There's a loophole that just makes it unenforceable.
Mm-hmm.
And that Al Nagel can probably speak better to that, the issues that they're having with enforcement.
Okay. How many times has it come out that a builder has built a house for himself, his wife, his kids, whatever else?
Senator Olson, through the chair, I believe the Department of Labor folks will be able to speak more clearly to the statistics and the abuses that have occurred.
So at this point, who are we having?
Mr. Nagel?
Online. Mr. Nagel, are you online?
I am here, Mr. Chairman.
Could you please state your name for the record and who you're associated with? And then if you have a brief testimony, we probably have some questions for you.
All right. My name is Al Nagel, N-A-G-E-L. I'm manager of mechanical inspection for the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. And I'm really online to answer your question, should you have any.
Senator Olson?
Mr. Nagel, did you hear the question that I had before?
I got the gist of it through the chair, Senator Olson. I got the gist of it. If you'd like to restate it so that I don't misinterpret it,
sure. Let me give you the background where I come from. I built a hangar after I got a lease from the airport on the airport up in Barrow, and decided to go ahead and build it myself. So we put up a 90 by 70 hangar with just four of us there. Obviously, it's an owner-builder situation. Had I been under this, I'm afraid that people that are like that, that don't have the ability to have an owner-builder, they're going to be essentially aced out by some of these larger organizations. For example, the Alaska Home Builders Association, and now I realize that's on a different level. But still, when you have an organization like that that can go ahead and put regulations and put statutes through that may adversely affect the owner-builder to go ahead and build it, I find it somewhat reprehensible that it may be happening. So how do I allay those people that are say that, yes, this is indeed a monopolistic move by some of these protected membership organizations that are out there?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, as I read this, Senator, it would not, the example you gave, it wouldn't have prevented you from doing that yourself. This is more a matter, again, as I read the proposed language, to prevent someone from doing that on a regular basis.
I couldn't, Mr. Chairman, if I could continue. You're saying if I got another lease at the Nome Airport, which I already do, I couldn't put another one up and doing it on a regular basis? Or if I wanted to add on to the hangar because I have excess space up in Barrow, that I couldn't do it?
No, that through the chair, Senator Olson, that's not what I'm saying. And again, the department did not propose this language, so I'm going by the same reading you are, if you will. But my understanding of it is that the first hangar that you built would be fine, and the intent of it would be that you possibly could not build a second one for 2 years. That's the existing language. It's already in statute. The proposed language would prevent you possibly from selling it for the two-year period before you could start the second building, which, again, that's existing language. That's not new. And as far as the part of your question concerning you possibly remodeling it, that wouldn't be affected by this at all, is my understanding.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Ritchie, any questions?
Actually, Mr. Chairman, I do have another concern.
Senator Olson?
Mr. Ritchie, Mr. Nagel said that it wasn't the intent language of the Department of Labor that put the intent language or the language in here. What was the reason for the language? I'm assuming it came from the sponsor.
Senator Olson, through the chair, we did work with the Home Builders Association to develop some language that allowed the department to decipher intent. That's really the focus of this legislation, is to allow reasonable exemptions and reasonable people to make reasonable decisions, not exclude the owner builder and being able to provide or build your own house, fourplex, commercial property, whatever the case may be, but certainly give the department some more strength to decipher who is trying to sell, build and sell, and who is trying to build on their own and act as their own general contractor for their own interests.
Mr. Chairman, one thought, Senator. One comment I'd like to have, whenever you talk about quote-unquote thought, deciphering somebody's intent, that reminds me of thought police. I don't think we're in that kind of a society right here. And so I guess I've got reservations about this, some of the language in this bill, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Is Gray Mitchell Would you like to come up, please? And I have to caution folks that may be online, we probably will not get to the last bill of the day today, that bill being SB 193. Sorry, Senator. We'll have to move that to another meeting. But, Mr. Mitchell, please state your name for the record, who you're associated with, and if you have any comments, and
you can ask questions. Gray Mitchell, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Labor and Workforce Development. I don't have any comments and here to help with any questions that I can.
Senator Olson, do you want to restate any questions? Or?
Yeah, actually, as you look at this bill, is the department in favor of the bill?
We're neutral on the bill, through the chair.
Why have you not positioned yourself in favor or against it? You've studied it.
I think at this point we're waiting to hear what kind of comments come in on the bill. As the bill proceeds, we may develop a position. Sure. Through the chair.
Do you understand where I'm coming from, though? Where some of these larger organizations with large memberships with dues that are there can go ahead and put through statutory requirements as well as regulations to go ahead and hamstring those of us that are more independently minded and don't have access to a contractor out in rural Alaska?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I do understand that, and I don't believe that the intent is to hamstring a true owner-builder. I think the legislation is intended to address people who are kind of pretending to be owner-builders and are actually in businesses where they are rolling over a product every couple of years and selling it in the marketplace. Other businesses have to have licenses, bonding, insurance, and, of course, they're looking over the fence at someone who's doing that and saying, why shouldn't they have insurance? Why shouldn't they be licensed? And I think that's the intent of the bill, is to kind of separate the true owner builders from these people who are out there kind of trying to use the exemption of an owner builder, but really they're acting as a contractor.
Mr. Chairman, if I could think,
Senator,
in your position as the Department of Labor regulator or whatever capacity you have there, how many times have you seen this situation happen? Where the owner-builder is indeed somebody that has ill intent.
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I think Al Nagel may be a better person to answer that particular question. He does deal with the enforcement specifically. Mm-hmm. I can tell you that just anecdotally, it does happen on a regular occurrence, but because there isn't a way to particularly identify people who are acting in this capacity and rolling properties over, we haven't really tracked it as tightly as we could, but perhaps Mr. Nagel can add some clarity.
Mr. Chairman, before we continue, go to yes. Mr. Nagel. I guess that's my question, is that if somebody is charged from a regulatory standpoint and they got to go and defend themselves as an owner-operator, you're talking about lawyer's fees and whatever else. The Department of Labor, they don't pay for their lawyer's fees. They got staff lawyers that are on staff all the time. So the poor private person out there that's trying to build has got to go defend himself, and let's say he does have a judgment that's in his favor. You know, you've just put the guy out thousands and tens of thousands of dollars, because I've been in legal disputes myself, and sometimes I win and sometimes I win even bigger. So, with all due respect, you know, we're trying to keep the lawyer. I mean, the lawyers are busy enough already, as far as I'm concerned. We've got enough lawyers.
Senator Olson, just to add a comment, my understanding the purpose of the bill is not to prevent you or I or anyone else from doing what you said in terms of building hangars or building homes, home for yourself. My understanding of the purpose of the bill is you have folks that are employed in an industry that are working to certain standards, including insurance, training, et cetera, trying to produce a product for a customer. In other words, the purpose of their business is to churn out homes. And then there is and I don't want to say this in a negative per se, but there's a shadow type of business that does the same, does not necessarily work to the same standards, but their purpose also is to churn out homes. My understanding is that this bill or the position of the bill is to clarify, I think, what's already in regs and statutes to some degree, but also not to prevent individuals like yourself or myself from building a home, which we did, or building a shop, which we did, or building those type of buildings for the purposes of ourselves or a child, but to use that process to actually perform a business. That was my understanding. Mr. Nagel, are you online still?
I am.
Do you have any comments that you can add to this discussion?
I think the only thing I'd reiterate again is that the existing language certainly protects the rights of an individual who wishes to build their own home to exercise that Alaskan spirit, if you will. The intent of this is more to protect against people acting as general contractors who don't take on the responsibility of the insurance and the bonding and the licensure involved. In answer to Senator Olson, I can't give you a number at this juncture, but I can tell you that we do find in areas of the state where individuals come into an area and they do routinely build residential structures for the most part, that they hold no licensure, they hold no insurance, they hold themselves out to be an owner-builder, when in fact the for sale sign oftentimes beats the paint drying.
Senator.
Mr. Nagel, I guess the question that I have is, or I guess the answer to the question that I had is that you don't have any numbers of people that you've tracked in your position as a regulator out there of people that are infracting on what this bill is intended to do. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I don't have those numbers at hand. I can tell you, or I can get for you, the number of unlicensed contractors that we've taken enforcement action against. Unfortunately, I don't track it by whether it's an owner-builder or that type of category.
Last question, Mr. Senator. Mr. Nagel, is those of those numbers of people that you've taken enforcement action against, how many have been successful? Where the state has prevailed and the owner or owner-builder has not prevailed?
Through the chair, I think in understanding of what we call an enforcement action, you had alluded earlier to some litigation. We don't, as a routine matter, we do not haul people into court, if you will, paraphrasing or using cliche, for first offense. We have an administrative fine, which we can issue. We have a civil order to cease and desist, which we can issue. To get the cease and desist order lifted, it's a matter of mere compliance, and it automatically lifts, if you will. The administrative fine has certainly a right to hearing, an administrative hearing, but we don't exercise the criminal penalties of the current statute a first, or for that matter a second time. Generally we start to consider that with the district attorney at a third offense or subsequent to that.
You have to leave, Senator?
I do. The only problem that I've got is that if you start dispensing of fines to people, it costs more to go ahead and defend the fine, even if you think you're innocent, than it is to go ahead and pay for it. So I see that some of these actions, that which the numbers may look like he's on the side of providing protection, but in all reality, the practicalness says that he'll pay the fine and avoid the court fees.
Well, we're going to continue with the bill. We haven't opened up public testimony yet, but we're going to continue with the bill, asking questions, very good questions, getting information, and hopefully we'll get answers for everybody. So it's after 3 o'clock. We're going to let's take a brief at ease here. Session. At this point, we're going to adjourn. We're over our time, and we'll be picking this bill up again, 189, and continuing with the discussions as well as the other bills that we've missed.
Chairman,
Senator Bucicki.
Just before you adjourn, although that was a long discussion, what this bill does is allows people to build a structure once every 2 years, and the changes simply make it so you couldn't sell that structure in between that time. If you're in the building business, you should become a building contractor. This still allows home building, doesn't change a thing. So, and I know we can pick it up at the next meeting. It just I just wanted to make sure that anyone watching doesn't lose fact about what the bill actually does.
I appreciate that, and that was the purpose of putting the bill together. So with that, we're going to adjourn, and we'll pick up these bills at the next meeting. Thank you.